Today at Reader's Corner, Cy Montgomery, author of The Soul of an Octopus, a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. What's it like to be an octopus? Is it anything like being a human? Is it even possible to know? In her book, The Soul of an Octopus, Cy Montgomery explores these questions as she delves into the physical and emotional world of this mysterious and deeply misunderstood creature. Octopuses have three hearts, a brain that wraps around its throat, eight appendages, blue blood, and a covering of slime instead of hair. For centuries, they have been portrayed in popular culture as ugly and frightening monsters. Yet as Ms. Montgomery eloquently writes, octopuses also are highly intelligent, have distinct personalities, and are as curious and playful, traits they share with many other species, including us. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Cy Montgomery. She is a prolific author, naturalist, documentary scriptwriter, and radio commentator who has traveled to some of the world's most remote places for her work. The Soul of an Octopus was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2015. It's now out in paperback. Ms. Montgomery joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, New Hampshire, for this interview. Cy Montgomery, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much.
It's great to have you here. I'm going to start off with a little admission. So many of our listeners want to know, where do you get your ideas for books? And I'll tell you where it came from. It's NPR. It was a report months ago about the octopus that slithered out of the aquarium one night, of his tank one night, went like 8 to 10 feet across the floor, found a drain pipe, and found his way to freedom. And I thought, you know, I have seen these things on the menu, and this guy had enough smarts to figure out a way to get out. I've got to learn more about this. I Googled. Actually, I didn't Google. I went straight to Amazon, put in octopus. Your book came up, Cy. And what a pleasure it's been to read it. But I guess that gets to perhaps the very heart of what we're learning about the octopus. There's a lot of intelligence there. And these guys really are escape artists.
Yeah, they are amazing. And, you know, some people have said, in the case of Inky, I got a lot of calls from folks saying, what was this octopus thinking? Why was he leaving? Was he unhappy? And my answer was, I doubt he was unhappy, but he was curious. I mean, when the astronauts leave the Earth to go to the moon, it wasn't because they didn't like it here. It was because they wanted to know what was beyond. And that's the case with these animals. They're extremely curious. They're curious enough to want to play with toys. They're curious enough to want to reach out to us and play with us. They use tools. They actually garden. You know the octopus's garden song that the Beatles performed? They weren't so far off.
That's right.
They do all these amazing things that we do. And yet, you could not find an animal more unlike us unless you went to outer space or science fiction.
So how many
that's what fascinated me.
Exactly. How many different kinds of octopuses are there? And we'll explain in a moment why we call them octopuses and not octopi. Maybe you can do that.
Sure. Well, there's over 250 species, and they're finding new ones all the time. And they range from these little tiny, less than an inch long guys to animals who are see-through, to the Dumbo octopus, who looks like he has these big ears. He has fins on the side of his head. There's deep-sea octopuses that live in the dark depths and glow. The largest is the giant Pacific octopus, and that's the one that I got to know the best. But to explain why they're called octopuses and not octopi is apparently you're not supposed to put a Latin ending, I, on a Greek word, octopus, to make it plural. So even though octopuses sound so weird and your lips just keep moving and moving and moving long past the point that you wish they would stop, it's polite to say octopuses if you are around people who study them, or else they will become upset.
So give us a physiology description of this creature. What does
it
have?
Here's an animal. He goes, you know how we go head body limbs, they go body head limbs. The thing that we think is their head is really their thorax, or the place where they keep things like their stomach and their breathing apparatus, their gills. Their mouths are located in their armpits, and they possess not teeth, but a beak like a parrot. They can shoot ink like an old-fashioned pen. They have suckers all over their arms, which are capable of a pincer grip like you can do with your thumb and forefinger. These suckers are so dexterous that they can untie knots made with surgical silk. They can taste with all of their bodies, and they can pour their bodies through a tiny opening, not to mention change color and shape.
Why do they change color and shape? Or let's say color. Is this to avoid predators?
It's to avoid predators, but also two other things. It helps them hunt. They can conceal themselves while they hunt, or they can make themselves look like a completely different organism.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, they can create the impression that a cloud is passing over by going from dark to light. A dark cloud essentially will sweep over their body, and they do this voluntarily by changing millions and millions of chromatophores. And in addition, they kind of wear their hearts on their sleeves. They have three hearts, by the way, as well as blue blood, very different from us. But they show their emotions in their colors also. They use it to communicate, in at least some species, with other octopuses as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the octopus brain.
Oh, man, you wouldn't even know it was a brain. I mean, it doesn't look like our brain or any brains we really know well at all. Our brain, as your listeners all know, it looks kind of like a walnut in its shell, the shell being the skull. Well, an octopus not only doesn't have the shell, it doesn't have a skull, but its brain is wrapped around its throat. And our brain has four distinct lobes with a different function for each lobe. The octopus brain, depending on which of the 250 species that you're looking at, and depending on how you count the lobes, may number 50 to 75. And 3/5 of their neurons are not in their brain, as is the case with us, but they're in their arms, which means if you sever an octopus's arm, that arm can go off and do stuff for a while,
mm-hmm.
including stuff that you would think would require a brain. It can go off and hunt and capture prey.
Do I understand that these arms, if they're severed for some reason, can actually regrow?
Yeah, they totally mm-hmm. regrow. And they don't just regrow like a chameleon. I don't know if you had it at Knowles when you were growing up, but I had tons of these little mm-hmm. lizards in there. So great.
Right.
And whenever they want to escape from you, if you're holding onto their tail,
that's right.
sometimes you're left with this tail and the lizard runs away. Then they regrow their tail, but it's never quite perfect. With an octopus, the arm that regrows is perfect. And this is even the case with the octopuses. The male octopus has a specialized third right arm, which it uses to pass the spermatophore to the female. And if that arm gets cut off, it also regrows absolutely perfectly fine.
Some of these octopuses can be dangerous. Is that correct?
It's true. I mean, all octopuses have some kind of venom.
Mm-hmm.
And while not all of them are toxic to human beings, some of them are lethal to human beings. And I'm thinking, of course, of the blue ring octopus of Australia, whose venom can kill you and there is no known antidote.
Yeah, I was reading about that. And just to show you how much I got into your books, I went then, after I finished your book, and bought Jennifer Mather's book on the octopus.
Oh, great book.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And she talked about the blue-ringed octopus and how deadly it is. Where do you find that one?
They live in Australia. They're very common even in tide pools near Sydney. And mm-hmm. this is the funny thing. They're not as big as a giant Pacific. And some people have been bitten and not even realized they were bitten, but then noticed something was amiss when they stopped breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And all you can do for folks is kind of try to support their body and hope mm-hmm. that they weren't badly envenomated. But I believe all octopuses do have some kind of venom. And some of them have several different kinds of venom, a neurotoxic venom and a flesh-dissolving venom. And even the giant Pacific, who I handled all the time. I knew I personally made friends with several giant Pacific octopuses at the New England Aquarium. They came, they knew me, they looked me in the face, they recognized me, they could tell me from other people, and we know this because Jennifer Mather and others have done experiments showing that octopuses do recognize individuals. And I was never worried at all. But you don't want to put any part of your flesh particularly near an octopus's mouth just in case of an accident, even a giant Pacific.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Cy Montgomery, author of The Soul of an Octopus, a surprising exploration into the wonder of consciousness. Now, all four of the octopuses that you mentioned in your book that you befriended, those were all giant Pacific octopuses?
They were all giant Pacific. I got to know some other species in the wild because getting to know Athena and Octavia and Kali and Karma so well, I wanted to know, obviously you want to know of all your friends, what's it like to be you? You know, and this inspired me to learn scuba. And of course, I wanted to learn scuba so I could go meet some wild octopuses. Right. And so I got to know octopuses of other species as well. But the ones who I knew best and who I knew for years were the ones who were captive, who were living at the New England Aquarium.
Well, since the Boston Globe described you at one point as part Emily Dickinson and part Indiana Jones, I have no doubt that you would be the one that would find your way to scuba diving and wherever there are other octopuses besides the giant Pacific. But let's talk about the giant Pacific for a moment. We're only about 8 hours by drive time and an hour or so by flight from Seattle. So you went to the Seattle Aquarium, and of course you wrote this book while you were at the New England Aquarium. Let's talk about how you approach the tank of an octopus that someone like you, who had not had this experience before, how do you meet an octopus? What do you do physically to throw yourself over the side of a tank? You're not scuba diving because this is an aquarium. How do you do this?
Well, I had called New England Aquarium and asked to see if I could meet their giant Pacific octopus. So they took me behind the scenes and they opened the lid to the aquarium. And as you can imagine, you know, being such escape artists, the lid is quite heavy and tight fitting so that the animal can't get out. So as soon as the aquarist opened the top of that tank, Athena saw us, turned bright red with excitement and came flowing over to investigate.
Wow.
And I saw her eye swivel in its socket and lock onto our faces. And soon she started reaching up out of the water with her arms, with her suckers. And I asked, can I touch her? And the aquarist said yes. And so I plunged my hands and arms into the freezing cold water. And soon my arms and hands were covered with her suckers as she was tasting me and touching me. And then I asked, could I touch her head? And the aquarist said yes. And so I began to stroke her head. And her skin didn't feel like you expected. I mean, I had read Victor Hugo writing about, you know, as strong as steel and as supple as leather and how slimy they are. And I didn't expect it to feel great to be stroking this octopus, but it was lovely. It was smooth and silky, and she was soft as custard, and I petted her head like I would pet a puppy. And then I saw that she was changing color beneath my touch, and she had gone from red to white, and white, I had read, was the color of a relaxed octopus. So I just was thrilled. Because here was somebody, not something, who was just as curious about me as I was about her, and who seemed to be enjoying the touch of someone who wanted to touch her. And it was a thrilling experience. Then what happened was I felt her pulling and pulling. And I realized, you know, this animal is a very strong creature. If she stood up, she would have been about 4 feet tall, which meant her arm span was more than 8 feet. And each sucker, a large 3-inch sucker, has the capacity to lift 30 pounds. So I was dealing with somebody who was way stronger than I was. And I would have loved to have gone into the tank with her, except A, I wouldn't fit, and because she would have wanted to pull me into her lair, and B, I needed to breathe air, unfortunately, so I couldn't go in with her. But wow, it was such a great experience. I hadn't expected that. I mean, I hadn't expected to be frightened. I kind of went in there just hoping I would see what she was like. But I got a really more enthusiastic welcome than I had expected. And so, it was then that I started imagining this to be more than just an article, but a book.
Right. So under the category of mark your calendars, every Valentine's Day at the Seattle Aquarium, there's a special octopus blind date, and you were able to see that as well. Explain what explain as much of what you can explain to our listeners.
Well, again, you know, my long-suffering husband, it's Valentine's Day, and I have gone to Seattle to watch two octopuses have sex. But so do hundreds of other people, including busloads of school children. So what they do there is they have an adult female giant Pacific octopus and an adult male. And for a couple of days, through a permeable barrier, they've been able to taste each other's chemistry. And on February 14, the Aquarius removed the barrier between the two and let them meet. And it's always very fraught because sometimes an octopus blind date ends up being a dinner date, quite literally, because they do sometimes eat each other. Once this happened happily before the public had arrived, but it kind of ruined the blind date. So the time I was there, it was amazing how it went. And once I described this to a friend when I was traveling on a train to New York, and as I started to describe how she flew into his arms and they flushed red with excitement, and soon their six hearts were beating as one, and their suckers were tasting and holding each other. And I noticed that the car was totally silent, and every one of the commuters was listening to this with unnatural interest, wondering what on earth was this woman describing. But it really was a very intimate and sexy thing that was going on. She and he are not just touching each other but tasting each other. She was enveloped with his entire body. And it was very lovely. And the people at the octopus blind date, I didn't hear any snickering or kind of snide remarks. Some people were confused. I mean, it was hard to tell how many octopuses were involved or what they were doing. The school children, to whom human sex is a complete mystery, were utterly mystified and had no idea what was going on. But the folks who knew that these two animals were mating found it very lovely. And that was very moving, too, that here two creatures so different from us were enjoying something that humans, too, find enjoyable and moving. And we could relate to what was going on in their lives.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Cy Montgomery about her book, The Soul of an Octopus. The book explores the emotional and physical world of this fascinating and often misunderstood creature. So it's pretty unlikely, isn't it, that an octopus can even become an octopus? Help our listeners understand the chances of an octopus becoming an octopus.
Well, a giant Pacific will lay 100,000 eggs, and only two of those are likely to hatch, grow, meet another octopus, mate, and lay eggs. Otherwise, we'd be up to our lips in octopuses. Most octopuses get eaten by somebody else, including people. People do eat them. And when they are eaten, they are, you know, eaten alive. So it's a hard life being an octopus.
And not exactly a long life.
No. They only live 3 to 5 years. And by the time you meet one in the aquarium, for example, someone who's big enough to be displayed at an aquarium is already well over a year old and maybe much older.
So
they're going to break your heart.
Well, I know. Well, your heart gets broken in this book a couple of times when you have to part with these lovely creatures. And I want to jump to a section that I guess I would call my dog underwater, questions about animal intelligence. How did we come to see that octopuses are as intelligent as they are, as problem solvers? When did this all come about? I mean, it's not exactly ancient theories here we're dealing with.
No, you know, and Aquarius knew for many years that these guys were very smart because they'd see them get out.
Yeah.
They would not just see them get out, but they'd see them play with stuff, figure things out. Even home Aquarius, there's certain species that you can keep at home, and they would notice that the octopuses had distinctive personalities, and some of them would play with them, some of them would initiate play, some of them would call the person over to them when they felt like playing by knocking something over, for example. So much is the case with dog owners. We've known dogs are smart. You know, we've known this for many years, but for the longest time, scientists didn't really want to accord animals' minds. And really, in modern times, it started with Jane Goodall, whose first papers about chimpanzees were rejected because she named them like people instead of numbering them like rocks, and recognized that they had individual personalities, and then discovered that they used tools and that they waged war, etc., etc. And she just went into the field in 1960, within my lifetime. So only recently have people been publishing the kinds of studies that show how smart octopuses are. And only recently have neuroscientists gotten together to sign this important document called the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness, stating that all vertebrate animals, as well as some invertebrates, including octopuses, have what they call the neural substrate to generate consciousness. And this is a game changer, I think, for our relationships with animals. Because until very recently, animals were only seen as property or as food or as nuisances. Those of us who owned pets understood them as companion animals, but they were not treated that way by scientists or by the law or by laboratories or by farms. And I think the Cambridge Declaration on Consciousness is going to change things, all for the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. When did that actually become official?
That was just a few years ago. It was right before I finished writing this book. I think it was right before actually Jennifer Mather finished her book, which came out before my book. So it is very recent, and it's important. And Jennifer Mather, whose excellent book you mentioned and you have read, was one of the people who really pioneered our understanding of octopus psychology, and who established with the late Roland Anderson that octopuses play, that octopuses love to play with the same toys we give our children. And that octopuses have distinct individual personalities, that octopuses remember stuff and know us. And these are things that I experienced personally with the octopuses that I came to know and wanted to bring to readers. But she is really the one that brought it to the attention of scientists.
So does that mean that an octopus has a sense of self as we understand humans to have a consciousness?
They certainly have what I consider consciousness. If I have consciousness, I mean, some people say consciousness is a fiction. There's some philosophers and scientists who just say that it's a little story we make up to convince ourselves that we're the same person day to day. I don't think most of us believe that, but I believe that if I have consciousness and a soul, an octopus certainly has it. But what does it feel like to them? That we don't completely know, because their sense of self could be different. If your brain is not where most of your neurons reside, your arms might have a separate set of consciousness. They might have a more diffuse sense of self, or they may have a sense of multiple selves. Who really knows? But they know not to attack their own arms, for example. They know that they are a different thing than I am. and they know that I am a different thing than someone else's, even if we dress identically. And they may know more about us than some of our friends do. Because, for instance, you know, they taste with all of their skin and they are capable of discerning chemicals in very small concentrations. They could be tasting our neurotransmitters as they flow in our blood. And this is something that your husband and your wife and your best friend and your colleagues can't do. And I had an experience with one of these octopuses that as I was running up the little steps to greet the octopus, I stubbed my toe and hurt it. And, you know, you can feel that coursing through your blood. You feel the pain coursing through your blood. And I think the octopus could taste that too. I witnessed another incident in which a young friend who had a number of problems health-wise, she was on some new medicines, many of which were intended to change her brain chemistry. She just changed medicine, and the octopus, who liked her, bit her, did not envenomate her, but bit her. And this well could have been because she tasted her blood changing with these medications. So they could know all kinds of cool stuff about us, whereas we're just starting to learn about them.
Well, given what you're talking about here and the Cambridge Declaration you mentioned earlier, I was going to ask, and you answered this to some extent, what implications are there for the treatment of these creatures? I mean, there has to be some long-term implications of how we as humans treat creatures who we're learning are coming closer and closer to some form of intelligence we share with them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is now perfectly legal to take a baby octopus and throw it into sizzling oil and then serve it to somebody. Perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal to take an octopus out of the water and while it's still alive, chop it up into pieces and use it as bait. But one day, I think this is going to change. It's slow, though. I mean, when you look at it, we are allowed to take chimpanzees who are so closely related to humans that you can get a blood transfusion from a chimp and incarcerate them, inject them with diseases, and watch what happens. You know, we put them in jail, having done nothing wrong. And even dogs, what we're allowed to do in laboratories to dogs. I mean, everyone knows how much dogs long for company and comfort, and that they certainly, without a doubt, not only feel physical pain, but they feel lonely, they feel scared, they feel happy. And yet it is perfectly legal to conduct medical experiments on them that wouldn't be possible to do on humans. But we're not all that different from the rest of animate creation. This is the thing. You know, we share 99% of our genetic material with a chimp, but we share 90% of our genetic material with all placental mammals. So I think what we're learning is that the world is far more alive and cognizant and animate and mm-hmm. thrilling and complex than we dare to imagine. And that, to me, is wonderful and exciting news.
Cy, we've run out of time, but boy, you've summed it up. And the one thing we did not have a chance to talk about, which is an awfully good reason for people to pick up a copy of this book, is there's a human side to this book and a set of human stories about the people who dedicate their lives as volunteers and aquarists at these aquariums and out in the wild doing what they do. And you've told some beautiful stories about the people who make the difference here in the work you're doing. Thank you so much today for joining us on Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book, The Soul of an Octopus, A Surprising Exploration into the Wonder of Consciousness by Cy Montgomery. Thanks, Cy.
Thanks so much, Dr. Kostra.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Cy Montgomery. Next week, H.W. Brands, author of The General versus the President, MacArthur and Truman at the Brink of Nuclear War. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.